The speaker that we have coming on next is Stephen Day. He's with SRK, and he'll be presenting on geochemical characterization. Stephen has a Master of Science degree. He's a practice leader and corporate consultant at SRK Consulting with 23 years of experience in geochemical characterization of mine waste, water chemistry predictions, and conceptual waste management planning for mining projects in Western and Northern Canada, the United States, and South America. Very happy to introduce Steve. He's a great colleague and look forward to his talk.
Thank you, Jane, and good afternoon, everybody. I hope that you've enjoyed a good lunch and can stay attentive after all those lovely profiteroles and eclairs and things, which are very tasty. It's a pleasure to be up here in Anchorage again, see some familiar faces and catch up with you. I'd like to just introduce my the co-author on this, who's Dr. Claire Linklater. Claire is actually based in Australia. Some of you will have come across her through other meetings. But her she was formerly with ANSTO, which some of you will recognize the name if you're in this field, and worked on the sulfidox model, which is one of the models that's out there for modeling sulfide oxidation. So a lot of this material today, many of you that have been through these meetings before will recognize. So it'll be a bit of a refresher for you. I'm going to go over the geological context, and I know that you've seen some of that already this morning. But if you're not a geologist, it probably will help to see it again. And then just briefly about the objectives of the programs, and then I'll get into some of the results. So I think that you'll have seen the geology this morning from Louise. But just to remind you, this is a geological map of the project, and it illustrates the dominant geological features of the project. And I guess I don't have really a way to point on this, but the big green area on the right is the what we call the tertiary cover on the deposit, which is an area which is unmineralized. And then to the left, the other colors, the sort of pinks and purples, are the mineralized rock of the project. And that's what it looks like in plan view. And it's a little easier to understand it when we look in section. And this is a fairly old section, but it illustrates quite well the geological features of the project. And just to kind of, and I'm not sure what Louise talked to you about this morning, but just to remind you, the pebble deposit was formed in a subvolcanic environment. So it was very interesting to hear about when I came in this morning, about talking about the recent volcanoes and the subduction zone and the faults. Pebble deposit, if you kind of take your geological remote control and do a rewind, a few hundred million years, you'll go back to a similar environment where there were volcanoes, with hot water circulating beneath the volcanoes, dissolving metals out of the rock, and then concentrating them into what we call the pebble porphyry deposit. It's a type of mineral deposit. And on the cross-section here, the geological cross-section, the minerals were concentrated in the gray and pink colors on there. And then at some time after the mineralization formed and the volcanoes had cooled and the rocks had cooled down, mountain building continued, and the deposit was eroded. And then along came these later rocks, which we call tertiary rocks. It's a geological time, refers to the geological time, were deposited on top of the mineralized rocks. And as I mentioned, they're formed after the mineralizing event. So they're effectively unrelated to the mineralizing event. They weren't affected by the hot waters that were moving and concentrating metals. But nonetheless, they're an important part of the project, and you'll see, and many of you that have seen this before, that that's an important distinction for when we look at the chemical characteristics of the rock. So why do we do these studies? So really the first objective is that we need to understand what will happen when rock and other types of wastes are produced by the project, and what happens when those get exposed to the environment and then get environment being atmospheric conditions, and then you get rainfall events, snowmelt events, and you get water that comes in contact with the waste. That's one of the big objectives of this work, is to understand what happens when those processes occur. And a lot of the test work that we do is very much directed towards potential, which is what could happen, which leads into the second objective, which is to come up with information which will help the engineers that are designing the project to design the project so that we can deal with some of the things that we identify about the chemical properties of the rock. And that's when our findings get passed over to companies like Knight Piésold to do their designs so that they can come up with ways of managing the waste and the water so that we can minimize project effects. The statement of objectives here, it looks like it's just two things, but they're very much linked, of course, in that when they come up with designs, then we want to then understand what does their design do for the chemical properties of the wastes. So it's very much an iterative process that we have findings, designs are done, and then we look at the findings again. So when we go into this, the sort of the details of that, and just to try and summarize it into the kind of main questions that we deal with. The first one is that, as I mentioned, a lot of the tests that we do deal with what we call potential. So that we're interested in, one of the big ones you'll have heard about is acid rock drainage, which is the potential for mine wastes to leach acidic waters. So again, it's looking at the potential. Could it happen? The other part of it is, and the reason we're interested in that is because if you have acidic conditions, then you know that you can get accelerated leaching. The other part of it is that mine wastes, or rocks in general, will leach regardless of whether you've got acidic conditions. So that we refer to the other part of the equation as metal leaching. We need to understand how mine wastes will behave, what will leach from them, regardless of whether we have acidic conditions or not. And a lot of the tests that we do to look at potential, there's this term static tests, and it really means trying to get an understanding of the bulk characteristics of wastes. The second thing that we're interested in is, and this kind of goes to our work with the engineers, is coming up with criteria or design criteria that they can use to design the mine waste facilities. And some of those criteria we can develop using the static tests again. But then we also move into a type of test called kinetic tests, which is really how fast do things happen. We're trying to measure reaction rates. So we're going from potential, as in could something happen, to what is the rate at which it could happen, rather than just the potential. And then the third part of it is that we do need to come up with water quality predictions. So that we, working with the waste facilities as designed, and that would go into sort of the water management design and also affect assessments for the project. And again, we can use static tests for that, but again, these kinetic tests we do come into it. This table, I'm not going to go into it in detail. It's just an illustration of the types of tests we do, and those of you who are familiar with this field will recognize some of these names. I'm going to just highlight just some of them, just so that those of you who are not familiar with it will understand what some of these buzzwords mean. The first line on there is acid-base accounting, and that is the first type of test that we do to measure the balance between components of a rock that can produce acid and components that consume acid. And so that's our first test of potential, is can a rock or mine waste produce acidic water? And it's about the balance between different types of minerals. And it's called acid-base accounting because it's looking at the balance and a count between the two types of minerals. Mineralogy is a very important part of this work, so we do mineralogical studies. And then we have some tests that we do that look at leachability. The fourth one down the line there is MWMP, and that stands for Meteoric Water Mobility Procedure, and that's a test that was developed to look at what happens when meteoric water, as in snowmelt or rainwater, contacts mine waste. humidity cells are one of these what we call kinetic tests, where you take a sample and you put it in a simulated weathering environment to see how fast the mine waste would oxidize. And that's done under a variety of conditions, the kinetic tests are, but humidity cells are done under lab conditions. I'm not going to try and explain bagged weathering tests to you. It's a very technical sounding test, but we'll explain that a little bit later. There's two types of columns mentioned there, and these are another type of kinetic test where we take mine waste and put it in a plastic column and look at what happens when you pass water through it. And then the last one on the list there, really important tests, are to try and look at how mine waste behave under site conditions. And that's one of the kind of the big linkages that we have to do when we do this type of program, is to take our lab tests and try and understand what does that mean for under field conditions. And it's one of the areas that we grapple with in this area, because of course in the end we need to translate our findings into field conditions. So we'll go into more detail in some of these, but that hopefully gives you an overview of some of the tests. You can look at the numbers there, and you'll see that acid-base accounting is one of the big ones we do. The thing that isn't listed on the table is all the tests that the exploration companies, has come out of the drilling programs. There are tens of thousands of chemical analyses that are done as part of that, and they also give us information which feeds into the project. This table is just a summary, a bit more detail on kinetic tests here. Again, I'm not going to go into it, but one of the things about kinetic tests which is useful is to have them running for a long time. And when I first got involved in the project in 2004, shortly after that in 2005, we actually did start some lab humidity cells. And so now we've got test work that's been running, some of it starting in 2005, so we've got 7 years of test work. And that's a very, very attractive thing to have, because starting to get a feel for what happens over many years. And it's useful data to have in terms of predicting long-term performance. So now that's the sort of an overview of the tests and some of the time frames involved. I'm now going to move directly into the work that's been done on geochemical characterization of waste rock. This is just a map that shows all the sampling that's been done. And again, we'll go into the details here, but I don't know if you can highlight that green line, which kind of goes down the middle of the diagram there. On the right of that line would be that green tertiary rock, and on the left would be the exposed mineralized zone. The dots are all the places that we've sampled, the colored dots, sorry, are all the places that we've done sampling over the years. The black dots are all the places that drilling has been done as part of mineral exploration. And again, as I mentioned, all of that drilling feeds into our interpretation of the geology of the deposit and the geochemistry of the deposit. So we know more than just appears in from our test work. We know all about the chemistry of the rock from the exploration work as well. So first thing on this potential for rock to produce acid rock drainage. And many of you will have seen this slide over the years before, and it illustrates very well one of the sort of special features of pebble, which is that the geochemical characteristics of the rock types there are very distinctive. So if you could just sort of follow and look at the graph here, don't look at the words for a second. Each of those dots is a sample analysis point from acid-base accounting. And the bottom axis, the y-axis, is a measure of acid potential, and actually a measure of how much sulfur there is in the rock that could produce acid. The NP is neutralization potential, and that is the part of the rock that can consume acid. So when we do an acid-base account, we're looking at the balance between those two. And we measure these in the same units. They're measured in equivalents of calcium carbonate, which is an acid neutralizer. But we can measure acid potential in the same units. And we look at the balance between them. And when this first procedure was first developed in the 70s, it was very much based on looking at sort of an exact balance between the two measures. And that's what that diagonal line is going up the middle there. And if, in theory, if you're on that line, the one that runs sort of right on the diagonal there, you have an exact balance between acid potential and neutralization potential. If you're above the line, then you have an excess of neutralizing minerals. That means that the rock, in theory, would not produce acid. If you're on the other side of it, on the right-hand side of it, you have an excess of acid-producing minerals, and so there's a potential that the material could produce acid. So if you look at the two, hopefully you understand what the graph means now. If you look at the points there, the colors go back to that geological map. The green dots that are more up towards the left-hand side of the graph are for that tertiary rock, the rock that overlies the mineralization. The red dots are more from the mineralized zone, which are the mineralized rock. And so if you look at the diagram, you can see that they kind of divide themselves up very nicely into two sort of distinctive areas. What we've found as we've done test work for this project over the years, consistently found that the mineralized rocks have a potential to produce acid rock drainage. So it basically means that that makes us think about how do we manage it so that that doesn't happen. The green dots are from this tertiary rock, the cover rock, and they have a low potential for acid rock drainage. And we've consistently found that. If you look at this in a little bit of detail, you'll see that there's some green dots that actually go fall on the right-hand side of the line. And there are places in the tertiary rock, this overlying, the rock that's above the mineralized zone, that where the sulfur concentrations are high enough that rock does have some potential for acid rock drainage. So again, something that has to be considered when thinking about how to manage the mine wastes. So I think that's really kind of a big finding from the project, as I said over the years, that a consistent finding that's kind of held up as we've gone through this. So that's acid-base accounting. That's potential for acid rock drainage. Now what about looking at reaction rates? One of the things that we're very interested in when we know waste material has potential for acid rock drainage is when would it happen? Because we know that from experience at other mine sites, and there's lots of other mines like Pebble from the same type of mineralization, that we know that if there's a potential for acid rock drainage and it happens, it doesn't happen immediately the waste gets produced. There's usually a delay, and in some cases it can be many years. And so one of the questions we have is what could that time frame be for Pebble? And again, when I got involved in the project at the very beginning, I was very interested in the project had history, that there were actually drilling that had been done at the project going back into the 90s. And the core from that drilling had been left on site, and we had an opportunity to look at how that core had actually been sitting in the core boxes at site. How had that core behaved over time? And that gave us an opportunity to calibrate some of the lab tests we do to field conditions, and we found some nice consistent trends there. If you're interested in the details of this, I think you can read about it in the EBD. But we did find, looking at the graph here, that when we looked at age of core, and the axis on the bottom there is age of the diamond drill core, it's actually age is youngest is at the left-hand side and oldest is at the right-hand side because I've done in years, that as the core got older, we found that evidence of the minerals in the rock reacting was there, and we found that the older core, some of it had become acidic while sitting in the core boxes, and we could relate that back to the chemical characteristics of the rock so that we could look at the sulfur content of the rock and the acid base account, and we could make sense of it. And we found when we looked at that and extrapolating from the findings, that some of the rock could take up to 40 years to become acidic. And so that gave us a time frame to think about for this onset to acid rock drainage. These are just some photos to kind of relieve the graphing that you're seeing. And just to show you what some of these tests look like. The sort of most common test, as I talked about, is a lab kinetic test, so what we call humidity cells, and you can see them up in the left-hand corner there, a little column of rock with inside a plastic container, and it gets weathered with air is pumped through it, and we leach the rock to see what the chemistry looks like. The one in the bottom there is, we call them subaqueous columns, and these are looking at what happens to rock when it's put underwater. And this is probably as good a time as any to talk about these bagged weathering tests, which are not something that you'll be able to look up and find an ASTM procedure for. But there's something that we designed specifically for the project because we were interested in what happens when waste is left sitting and it's oxygenated. It's in the atmosphere. What happens when that rock then gets put underwater? And so we filled up these bags of rock, and we have periodically take samples out of them, and we rinse them to see what's formed. And they basically sit on this pallet waiting for us to sample them. So I'm looking at humidity cells in a little bit more detail. The purpose of humidity cells is to estimate reaction rates under aerobic conditions. So the test is designed to be fully oxygenated. We don't try and limit weathering conditions in them. So we're trying to understand the rate at which the minerals in the rock will react. And this is relevant to anywhere on the project where we might have this happening, which could be a waste rock dump, it could be walls of pits, it could be stockpiles. And we collect a variety of different samples to look at different rock types. We look at the mineralized rock, we look at the tertiary rock, we look at sulfur content, and we looked at the age of the rock as well. So, and you can see up there in the top corner there that we've had at various times 66 humidity cell tests running. So it's a very good sized program, and got some useful data out of it. This is just an example of some of the types of results that we see from humidity cells. This is a pH of leachate that's collected from these tests over time. The bottom axis there is in days. I don't know whether you're able to see that. This set of data goes out for 3 years, but we've got tests running for longer than that. Sometimes we run these tests and we find, as you can see on the bottom there, that the rock generates acid very early on. And in some cases, we can go for 3 years in these particular tests and not seeing any acidity generated. And some in between as well. One of the ways that we use humidity cells is to, as I said, is to provide design criteria for the engineering part of the project. And we can interpret the data to tell us how to interpret our asset-based accounting. So that the way that we interpret asset-based accounting data, there are prescriptive ways of doing it that have come down through the years from guidance documents, but then we can also try and develop site-specific ways of interpreting the data, and that's one thing that we can do from humidity cells. The other thing that we can do from humidity cells is look at how bulk characteristics of the rock relate to the way that the minerals in the rock react. And this graph illustrates the relationship between sulfide content of the rock samples under test, the amount of sulfur in there, the amount of the minerals that could produce acid, and then the left axis there is actually the rate at which those sulfur-bearing minerals are actually oxidizing and producing sulfate. And one of the things that we like to see when we do these types of tests is to see a relationship between things we can measure in the rock and how fast it reacts. And here we see a correlation between the sulfur content of the rock and how fast the rock is reacting. So that's the sort of finding we're interested in, because it then allows us to translate the bulk characteristic to the way the rock reacts in under atmospheric conditions. Another thing that we've done from humidity cells is we've looked at this question of how fast would acidic conditions occur, and this can link back to those I mentioned about looking at the core that had been sitting on site and how that had reacted over the years. And we can kind of look at we can make a calibration between what we see in the lab and what we see in the site. And what we found in the lab is that reaction rates are faster. That the rock actually is predicted to go acid faster under lab conditions than we actually observed in the field. That makes a lot of sense when we think about the effect of temperature on the chemical reactions. Site conditions, the average temperatures are cold. I don't know what the average temperature is. Somebody going to help me with that? No, I'm getting not getting any bites on that one. But we run the lab tests under room temperature, so it would be roughly 70 degrees Fahrenheit. A lot colder under field conditions. Chemical reactions are slower under field conditions, so we expect that when we do a lab test, things are going to happen faster. We found that, and it actually makes sense. This is just another graph of the same type relating what we can learn about copper leaching from humidity cells. The bottom axis there is pH. So the left-hand side of the axis would be acidic conditions. Right-hand side is, the bottom axis is acidic conditions, and the y-axis is the leaching of copper. And as we expect, and we'd be surprised if we didn't see this, copper leaches more under acidic conditions. And that's a very common finding. But again, it's supporting our knowledge of the project and showing how it links to experience that we've had elsewhere. So as I mentioned, one of the things that we keep coming back to on this is how do we interpret our lab tests to field conditions. And so we had some tests set up under field conditions. These are plastic barrels. They're like almost like giant humidity cells that contain around 600 pounds of rock. And we basically fill them up with crushed rock, and we leave them there, and there's a pipe that comes out of the bottom, and we collect the leachate from that, we analyze it. And we have parallel tests running, the same material under lab conditions, so we can kind of connect the two. And that's an important part of our understanding of how things connect between the lab and the field again. So these field tests, we've got a variety of different tests running. We've got tests running on the mineralized rock, and we've got tests running on that green wedge, the tertiary cover as well. And we've now got 5 seasons of data from this. Again, it's getting to be a very good data set. This is just an example of tests that we've had running on the mineralized rock, the pre-tertiary rock, and it simply shows date versus copper concentration on the y-axis. This is a bit more data than you have in the EBD. This shows the data going out to 2011. So these tests have been quite useful in providing some information about what kind of leaching we can expect under site conditions, and what kind of concentrations we might get when we expose these materials to site weathering conditions. So that if you just look at the top part of the table is for the tests that are running on the mineralized pre-tertiary rock. And you can see some of the sort of chemistry that we're seeing from those tests. We've had some that have produced acidic leachate, just like we would expect from the acid-base accounting data. And we can see what sort of copper concentrations we're seeing. Those are in milligrams per liter. So those tests have produced roughly 10 to 13 milligrams per liter on average. And then we've had the same test running on the tertiary, the cover materials, and we didn't expect that material to produce acid, and it hasn't yet. But it is, again, going back to the metal leaching question. What kind of leaching do we expect regardless of pH? You see that the pHs that we've had from those tests have been above 7, some of them into the mid-8s. But we've learned something about things. We note that sulfate will leach because there is sulfur in the rock. We've also noted that selenium leaching, we found concentrations of up to 0.1 milligrams per liter selenium leaching from these tests as well. So again, it's feeding us information about the leaching characteristics of these materials. So this sort of summarizes some comments from that. We have had acidic conditions from some of the some of the field tests, and we're getting kind of similar when we compare the lab and the field data. We're seeing similar results. We're seeing that the mineralized pre-tertiary rocks that were getting higher concentrations of some of the heavy elements like copper, which is not surprising. We look at the pre-tertiary rock, the tertiary rock, we also add to that that we're seeing, as I mentioned, selenium, but also some arsenic and molybdenum as well. So that kind of covers what we've learned about to date about rock that's exposed to fully atmosphere, you know, fully oxygenated conditions. One of the things that that we focus on in engineering studies and managing rock at these kinds of sites where we know that there's a potential for acid rock drainage is to put the waste underwater. And that's been discovered through decades of experience now, that if you can get reactive rock underwater, it actually does a really good job of slowing down the reaction rates and effectively preventing acid rock drainage from starting. So one of the things we've looked at is what would happen if you take this rock and put it underwater, and that's where these subaqueous or submerged columns come in. And we've sort of thought about sort of two aspects of that. One of them is that if in the course of mining, waste could be taken and put underwater immediately, what would the chemistry look like? But we also go back to saying, well, if it had to sit for a while and then got put underwater, what would the water look like as it goes underwater? And those are two important questions, because rock that sits and weathers under fully oxygenated conditions will build up soluble components over time, and then when you put it underwater, you can expect it to leach when it goes underwater. So we've tried to answer or gather data about those two questions. These bagged weathering tests that I referred to go to the second question. We also have subaqueous columns that are running on rock that was freshly crushed and put into a column directly. And we look at the same, this is some examples of the stored bag tests that we've done. And one of the things that we expected is as we leave them in the bags and we take a sample out early and then we take it out at different time steps, that as the rock sits there longer and longer, you think that it would build up more and more weathering products. It kind of goes without saying. And we're starting to see that in some of our tests. Just an illustration, I again won't go into this in detail, but the if you look at the blue line there, there was a series of samples that were collected earlier on, taken out of the bag, tested, looked at how much sulfate leaches out of them, that we actually did see from the early time, we got concentrations of around 600 milligrams per liter, and if you follow the line up there, the older it got, the longer it sat, we got up to 1800 milligrams per liter, and that subsequently you can see that it looks like it flattened off, which actually makes sense with the mineral that forms has a limit of solubility, and so that the result we're getting from that makes sense. This is just a photograph of these subaqueous columns that we run, and they are really a plastic column with a bunch of mine waste in them, and then put some water over it and look at what happens when the water moves through it. Again, we've got a variety of different tests running, different rock types, sulfur contents, trying to examine all the variables that could make a difference here. And I think I've talked about that, so we'll move on from that. Again, looking at subaqueous columns, the kind of data we get from them looks like humidity cells. We look at the way that concentrations change with time. Just look at an example off to the left there, just a trend in pH versus time for some different column tests. And you can see that one of the column tests actually was acidic in the column, which it doesn't really make sense. You think that it wouldn't, because that's the point, is to put it underwater to stop it going acid. But it turns out the sample was already acidic when it went into the test. So it just simply kept that condition going. So that covers what we've learned to date about waste rock characterization. I mean, there's lots of detail in the EBD you can look at and kind of fill in the gaps on that. Going to talk about tailings for a few minutes here. Am I doing okay with time here? I'm not following time. I'm okay. Thanks. So we take the same approach to looking at tailings. So what we do in the case of tailings is that the as part of the evaluation of the project over time, samples of ore are collected and they're run through what we call metallurgical testing. These tests are done, some of them are done in a small scale in the lab, and some are done what we call a pilot plant, where a large ore sample is collected and tested as if it were running through the plant that could be used for the project. And the metallurgical engineers do this, of course, because they want to learn about how the minerals of interest will be recovered from the ore. At the same time, we can get samples out of that to understand about how waste performs, and the waste is tailings. And so we perform the same kinds of tests on it. We look at asset-based accounting. We do kinetic tests as well. And one of the things about the way that copper ores are processed is we get two types of tailings out of them. One of them is a low sulfur tailing that comes out of it naturally. And what we found is, and you can see the number of years of test work that have gone on. We had tests that ran back in 2005, and this has continued for several years. What we found is that there's a component of the tailings which has relatively low sulfur content, and it has enough acid neutralizing minerals in it to offset the potential of the sulfur part of the tailings to produce acid. So again, this is acid-based accounting data. It's the same type of plot that I showed you before. You can see that there are a number of points that lie up in the left-hand part of the diagram, indicating there's an excess of acid-consuming minerals. And again, it's very important information for designing the project, because that's really the target. That's where you want to be, is to have tailings that have a low leaching potential. So again, useful data to have. We've run kinetic tests on these as well, and we've run humidity cells, much like with the waste rock, and we've also run leach columns to look at how water behaves when it moves through the tailings. You can see, again, we've got a good-sized program here. It's been 20 tests at various times have been run, and we have 11 that are continuing to run at the moment. The blue and red on this diagram are different zones of the deposit. So that's one of the things that the metallurgists will want to look at when there is to understand how different ores behave in the deposit. And we have the same question: how do the different ores behave, and what are the tailings? How might the tailings vary depending on the type of ore that's being processed? We do the same kinds of things that we do with looking at humidity cell data for rock samples. Is we try and build relationships between the bulk mineralogical characteristics of the sample and how it oxidizes, how it reacts. And I know this looks like a bit of a sort of a scatter of information here, but what we have discovered is, for example, that finer tailings react faster than coarser tailings, which makes sense because it's actually a kind of a surface area phenomenon. We've also found that higher sulfur tailings react faster than lower sulfur tailings. So those kinds of things are consistent with what we've learned elsewhere and make sense. Oops. Pushed too many buttons. I feel the same way about this as I do with my kids with a remote at home. They seem to know what to do with it, and I don't. So we get the same kind of information out of these tests, and I noticed on this one that we've somehow missed the bottom axis on this, but again, it's a time axis, and again, we've been running these tests for many years now, and starting to gather good information about tests that are predicted by acid-based accounting not to produce acid. We've been running them for years, and they're showing us that it confirms that conclusion that a tailings can be made that isn't acid producing. So to summarize where we're at with this, you see that we've been at this since 2004. We have a large database which is helping us to correlate geology to potential for metal leaching and acid rock drainage. We've developed a kinetic test database now that is helping us to direct engineering studies for the project, and also can be used for water quality predictions. And importantly, we're starting to develop an idea about how we link our lab tests to our field tests, which is very important. And we're also noting from tailings test work that that we can develop a tailings which has low ARD potential in the bulk tailings. I missed the thank you slide, but thank you for paying attention.
With that, we'd like to take questions. Okay, I have a question here. Your name and affiliation, please.
I'm Rick Parkin with EPA, and related to this, but slightly different, I wondered if you had any information on the potential leaching of the product concentrate.
Of the concentrate? Not in this program, we don't know.
Any other questions?
Kirk Nordstrom, USGS, also with Keystone Dialogue Process. It seems to me you have data on the weathering rate, both in field tests and should be comparable lab tests, except the main difference would be the temperature, I assume. And so you have a nice comparison of what the effect of temperature is on these rates. And I was wondering if you could tell us, you know, roughly, are we talking about an order of magnitude or more, or is it a rather small difference?
The scaling question. Thank you, Kirk. I'm going to have to disappoint you, I'm afraid, to tell you that I don't know. I can't tell you what that is today, but it's something that we'll be looking at the data for.
Other questions? It's a complicated topic and a lot to absorb in a short time. The EBD is a great place to go and through and spend some time with it if you really want to try to understand the effects of weathering and such on the rock and tailings. But we do have time for questions. Okay. Thanks very much, everyone. Thank you, Steve.